Hello, I'm Tracy Ullman. Leonard had to rush out, so I'm reading the intro to Lenny's bonus weekend podcast. And this week we are taking a look back at some brilliant former guests who have been recently honoured in big ways. In 2015, Leonard spoke with behavioural economist Richard Thaler for his book Misbehaving, The Making of Behavioural Economics. Just last week, he was awarded this year's Nobel Prize in Economics. On Wednesday, Viet Thanh Nguyen and Annie Baker were among the 2017 MacArthur Grant winners. Annie Baker has been a guest on this show a number of times, and we are revisiting the 2010 conversation with her for one of her earlier plays, Circle, Mirror, Transformation. And in May, Leonard spoke with Viet Thanh Nguyen, who had then been awarded the Pulitzer Prize for his collection of stories, The Refugees. So buckle up and have a jolly good listen. And it's goodbye from the BBC and Tracy Ullman and back to WNYC. Thank you very, 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 very much.
Goodbye, everybody. This is the Queen. Goodbye.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Traditional economics assumes rational actors. There's even a formula, optimization plus equilibrium equals economics. However, humans don't behave as Spock-like automatons, and that can lead to financial outcomes not predicted by the equation. Richard H. Thaler, a professor of behavioral science and economics at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business, has been studying the relationship between behavioral sciences and economics for his entire career. He argues in his latest book, Misbehaving, The Making of Behavioral Economics, that it's time for economic models to account for recent discoveries in human psychology and to replace the fictional human who has no emotions with the real one. It's published by Norton. I'm very pleased it has brought him back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you much. Good to be here.
You open with a few anecdotes about some of the men that you have most respected in your career and suggest that it will hint at what's about to come in the book. The first is about Amos Tversky, whose papers and talks you describe as precise and perfect. Did you work with him?
Yes, I worked with him. We wrote a few papers together. I wrote more with Danny Kahneman, his collaborator, who I guess we'll get to in a minute.
That's the second one.
But he was a big inspiration to me.
What does the anecdote you relate here reveal about him to the reader, or reveal about what you're talking about?
Well, the anecdote is that Amos sadly died at age 59 in 1996, and at his funeral, his son Oren read a note that Amos had written to him the last couple days, saying something about how Amos knew he was dying. He had pancreatic cancer, so he had lots of time to talk about it with his family, and he said that there's a long Jewish tradition that wisdom is passed on not through formulas and histories, but through stories and funny jokes. And that was my excuse for writing a book that's mostly stories.
The second anecdote involves Daniel Kahneman, who's been a guest on this show. And he described you in this way in an interview: the best thing about Thaler, what really makes him special, is that he's lazy. Did you take that as a compliment?
No. This was a very funny exchange. I happened to be in his living room, where I've spent many hours, and all of a sudden he remembers he's got a phone call coming from a reporter who's writing a story about me and wants to talk to my old friend and mentor, Danny. And then he said, "You want to leave?" No, I'll listen. It could be amusing. So he's having this interview, and then I hear Danny saying what you just read, and I'm waving at him and saying, "You know, really? I mean, okay, maybe I'm lazy, but is it my best quality?" And his explanation, he sticks to this story to this day. His explanation why it's a compliment is that he says that because I'm lazy, I'm only willing to work on things that are important. And so I think I only put in the book stuff that I could overcome my natural laziness enough to write down.
You write about the effect the perception of numbers can have on students. For example, you say that as a young professor, you gave a midterm exam meant to a group to group students into three categories: mastery, proficiency, and basic concepts, and of basic concepts, and those who didn't get it at all. And when you first made the test and scored it out of 100, what was the average?
So the average was 72, which was quite low. You know, these were graduate students at a Ivy League business school who were used to getting A's and A minuses. And so a 72 struck them as quite harsh.
And so they were very upset?
Oh, they were furious with me.
When you changed the total points to 137 on the exam, then what was the outcome?
Well, that exam turned out to be a little bit harder, 70% right. But the average score was 96. They loved me.
They didn't realize that they were actually getting less? These are future economists.
You know, I picked 137 with extreme care. In fact, I argue it is the optimal number of points for an exam because it's big enough that most people will get some score that looks quite good to them. A few even score above 100, which creates something like ecstasy. And yet 137 is hard to divide by, so most didn't bother.
So what happened with what did that 70% reveal? That they didn't get it at all?
No, it revealed that I wrote a really hard exam. And
and they didn't like you for it.
And they didn't like being reminded of that.
Aren't most economic models based on fictional people who don't misbehave? This is what we were talking about at the beginning. You call them homo economicus.
Yeah, well, that's the Latin term, but I prefer to call them econs.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, these econs are made up creatures. They're kind of like Spock on Star Trek.
Who made them up?
Economic theorists.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is economic theorists made them up because they, of their own lack of analytical abilities. And what I mean by that is, I mean, most economists are better at math than me, but in the 1940s and 50s, economics went through a transformation, becoming much more mathematical. And if you try to write down mathematical models, the easiest ones to write down are of people being smart. And if you try to write down a model of people that are humans and are full of emotions and where the wording of a question can influence the answer that you get, then the math just gets a lot messier. And so so it was easier to write down models of these fictional creatures.
But you write that Adam Smith understood that economics has to consider the human factor, because before he wrote The Wealth of Nations, he wrote another book devoted to the topic of human passions. He is a god to most of the economists. How come they didn't notice this?
Well, you know, The Wealth of Nations is probably 500 pages. And, you know, the truth is few economists read anything more than 30 years old. And graduate students hardly read anything more than 20 years old. So I have a quiz. I ask my students at Chicago, and maybe this won't be a surprise, how many of them have ever read Keynes? And the answer is zero.
Really?
I joke that it's on the forbidden reading list at the University of Chicago. But
have they read Milton Friedman?
I think probably not. Right. So they just don't read anything old anymore. And so, yeah, economists were behavioral up until about 1940. Certainly Keynes was. Keynes was a great behavioral economist. And people now just think of Keynes as deficit spending. And it's become politicized. You know, Richard Posner, who's hardly a liberal, went back and read Keynes for the first time. I think he was probably in his late 60s. and fell in love with it. And I suggest all readers go back and check it out of your library and read chapter 12. And you have to be impressed, no matter what your political persuasions.
My guest is Richard Thaler, who's co-author of the best-selling book Nudge with Cass Sunstein. He is a professor of behavioral science and economics at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. And for this year, he is the president of the American Economic Association. Congratulations.
Thank you. I don't know
if that's a good job or not.
You know, it's good to be elected. It's better to be past president.
We'll talk about that later. His book is Misbehaving, The Making of Behavioral Economics. If the models don't account for misbehavior, then they must be bad at predicting outcomes.
Well, that's exactly right. So if we think about the financial crisis, there was misbehavior going on everywhere. And, you know, we all know about people taking out mortgages that they wouldn't be able to pay back if interest rates ticked up after their teaser rate expired or real estate prices went down. And maybe that can be excused. They're unsophisticated. But what about the people who were selling them those mortgages? And more important, what about the people who were paying people $5,000 each for selling those mortgages, regardless of the ability to pay them back?
And what about the professionals who lost money?
You know, that's when I mean, there's misbehavior all the way up the line to the CEOs of big investment banks who didn't really understand what was in these fancy securities that they were selling.
You write, ironically, the existence of formal models based on the misconception of human behavior is what gives economics its reputation as the most powerful of the social sciences. Powerful in two distinct ways.
Yes, well, I mean, it's powerful in the way that, you know, we got models. They don't, you know. So
we use math
and you guys can't even understand it. So yeah, economists are pretty arrogant. They think they're the most physics like of the social scientists, but it's physics without the engineering, you know. So it's like physics if you ignored things like atmosphere. It wouldn't be very good at building bridges.
And every once in a while, you get a big bang, like the Depression in 1929 or the recession more recently.
Well, and you know, we've been having big bangs with greater frequency. So if you think in the last 20 years, we had the tech bubble and the real estate bubble and the financial crisis, and there's more misbehaving going on than ever.
And yet economists have the most power in determining policy.
Yeah, part of that, of course, is by default. So it's called the dismal science. I think in part it's because we economists make it dismal. But it's also that I think many people just find it boring. So if we could get psychologists and other social scientists involved in thinking about policy questions, which we're doing now, then they could help.
The core premise of economic theory is that people choose by optimizing. What does that mean?
It means that if you are deciding what route to take home tonight, you'll pick the best one. You'll choose as if you had Google Maps in your head.
Although Google Maps aren't always the best.
Well, you know, that's probably...
That's another issue.
Yeah, that's another
but,
issue.
But we have all these other things that affect our choices. If we pick a laundry detergent, for example, it's because our mother used that laundry detergent. That's why Tide has become so popular.
Yeah, and why they have 47 different versions of it taking up space in the aisle to fend off other brands. Yes, we're much more complicated than the creatures economists study, well, could, and more interesting.
Could they, that be written into an economic model, the power of brand identification, which can be irrational?
You know, the thing is, I think we want to not get hung up on the word rational, because it's kind of a loaded term. And people behave the way they behave. And the distinction is they're behaving differently than in economic models. And so the models are making bad predictions.
Every so often, the New York Times has a special edition, one of their many different things that they fold into the newspaper, called Retirement. We're going to take a little break and talk about, well, we can't use the word rational when we talk about retirement. But we can talk about related things, like
yes.
Social Security.
Yeah, sure.
And saving, and why people don't save well, and whatever.
You can use whatever words you want.
Okay. My guest is Richard H. Thaler. His latest book, Misbehaving, The Making of Behavioral Economics. It is published by Norton. We'll be back with more right after this. And we're back with Richard Thaler, co-author of the best-selling book Nudge with Cass Sunstein, author also of Quasi-Rational Economics and The Winner's Curse. He's a professor of behavioral science and economics at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, and for 2015 is the president of the American Economic Association. I mentioned retirement before you left. Since economists and their models influence public policy, making the assumption that people always optimize seems dangerous. One area in particular is about saving for retirement. Don't we have enough studies to prove that most people don't know how to properly save for retirement?
Yeah, I think we know that, and we should have known it all along. But in the gradual switch over from the old defined benefit kind of pension plans that were real pensions to 401ks, which are do-it-yourself savings plans, it took a while to figure out how badly those were working and how to fix them. And I think we now know basically how to fix them.
Well, there's been talk about privatizing Social Security, where people would be doing something similar to what they did with 401ks. Many people think that if we don't know how to do basic investing in the market anyway, this would be a disaster. Do you think it's a good idea?
No, I don't. I don't think it's a good idea. But the point I would want to stress is that probably the domain in which behavioral economics has had its biggest impact is in changing the way 401k plans look. So more than half of the large plans in the U.S. now include two features that I and my colleagues helped develop. One is automatic enrollment. So when you're first eligible, you get a big pile of papers, and it used to be you had to fill them out to join. Now you have to fill them out not to join. And now 90% of people join. And the second is automatic escalation, or what I like to call save more tomorrow, where you automatically increase the saving rates over time. Those things work.
But what about Social Security? People assume that when they retire, they're going to live off of the Social Security. It's not a lot of money. And even if you get the maximum, it's not a lot of money.
No, it's not a lot of money. That's why people better be using the 401k plan to their best advantage. Although even Social Security, there's only one choice you have, which is when to start claiming. And my advice is wait as long as possible.
And then they force you to take the money.
Then they force you to take the money, but not until you're 70 and a half.
You've called one of your chapters, What Seems Fair? And one question that you posed in the study behind the chapter is, a hardware store has been selling snow shovels for $15. The morning after a large snowstorm, the store raises the price to $20. And then subjects were to rate the action as completely fair, acceptable, somewhat unfair, or very unfair. What were the results?
People hated that. And again, this is a study that's a surprise only if you're an economist. Getting training in economics kind of gives you a sort of common sense amnesia. So any normal person would say, well, that's a ripoff. Why would you do that?
But is this a supply and demand issue?
Exactly. So people do not think that a blizzard is a good excuse for raising prices. And
even if the store is running out of shovels?
Even that they think it's more fair to go with first come, first serve.
In the study, you found that temporary spikes in demand are an especially bad time for any business to appear greedy. And you write that one new business that's ignoring this advice, possibly to its peril, is Uber. They charge more during peak hours, although I'm not sure you always know what the peak hour is until you handed the bill.
Yeah, that's right. It's not that I think variable pricing is necessarily a bad idea. Of course, airlines do it all the time. You pay more if you book at the last minute or at the holidays. I think Uber goes further with it than is smart. And they got into trouble for precisely the situation we described with our hardware store. So there was a blizzard in New York, and they raised the price by a factor of 10. People expect in society that when we have a big storm, we all chip in together. And that was kind of not in that spirit.
One of my producers told me that, I don't mean to pick on Uber, but I will, that she called Uber on a Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock to go from her home to Midtown Manhattan, which would have probably cost about $30, $35 in a cab. It cost her over $100 because they said it was a peak hour. Well, she was stunned.
Yeah. And
she'll never do that again. Well, so what would you suggest? What would you recommend that Uber do?
I would recommend that they cap the amount by which the price can surge. And in extreme situations, like in a blizzard, I would urge them to think of other ways of becoming helpers rather than offending people.
People often make financial plans for themselves, but they have a hard time controlling their impulses. How does behavioral economics control for a change in preferences or retail therapy that might throw a personal budget out of whack?
Well, the first thing behavioral economics does is recognize that we have self-control problems. You know, this, again, shouldn't be a big realization with quarter of the country obese and many people unable to save for retirement. And then once you recognize that, you say, well, what do I do when I have a self-control problem? You know, this morning I had to get up very early to be on some television show, so I set two alarm clocks, right? So it's just recognizing your own human weaknesses and then taking, it's like having piggy banks.
In the 40 years that you've been in the field, have you seen more acceptance of behavioral economics?
Absolutely. But it's not that I've changed anybody's mind. No, to a first approximation in academia, no one ever changes their mind. There's a famous line from Max Planck that science marches on funeral by funeral. And so there's lots of young economists that have taken up the call and they're doing all the work.
Getting back to controlling ourselves, why are some people better at saving than others? Is this something that we get from our parents?
Yeah, sure. There are. Yes, and yes. So, partly comes from your parents, but anybody who's had more than one kid knows that the kids come out differently, and so. Some have all their homework done before dinner, and some you're still yelling at late into the night.
And then one kid lives a very Spartan life, and the next one is a hoarder.
Right. So it's not all parents. Some of it is inborn. But the ones who have trouble with it are the ones for whom we need to help them, give them good strategies.
You write that, much to everyone's surprise, the behavioral approach to economics has had its greatest impact in finance. What impact has it had on finance?
Well, in academic finance, there has been a debate that I helped start in a paper I wrote in 1985 about what's called the efficient market hypothesis. And
does anybody go along with that anymore?
Some of my colleagues, some one of my most frequent golf buddies is a strong adherent of the efficient market hypothesis. So, you know, the argument is has two components. One is you can't beat the market, and the second is that prices are right. There are no bubbles. The first part is arguably, at least approximately, true. The second, I think we've seen enough of these bubbles now to realize it can be wildly off.
What happened, some people thought financial markets are a place where foolish behavior doesn't move market prices one iota.
Well,
has that proven to be true?
Let me tell you a recent story that illustrates the falsity of that. There's a mutual fund called that has the ticker symbol CUBA. It, of course, has nothing to do with Cuba. It's a Caribbean fund, but that's the ticker symbol. The day that President Obama made his announcement, this fund went from selling at a 15% premium to a 70% from a 15% discount to
so
a 70%.
So people don't do research.
You know, Cuba looks good. President's friendly. Prices pop. And I could give you many of those stories.
And this is all about people believing that they can beat the market. They saw Cuba. They immediately thought, I'm going to get in before.
Yeah, before everybody else, right.
Of course, there were many people who believed Bernie Madoff could beat the market and get great results. In fact, too many really smart people thought that. A few realized that what he was promising was impossible.
Right, but too few, and especially the regulators. And, you know, I come across sometimes as picking on my profession, and I don't think that should be overblown. Economists really are the only ones who understand how these things work. And one thing wrong with the SEC, I once had a conversation with the director of the SEC, and I asked her, what was the ratio of lawyers to economists at the SEC? And, it's more than 100-1. So they went in and inspected Bernie Madoff's operation two or three times and didn't see anything wrong.
Now, aren't computers supposed to get past the whole irrationality of humans?
Well, you know, computers are only as good as the programmer. So,
were they fooled by Cuba?
I doubt it. That sounds like a pretty human error to me. And the kind of people who buy that fund, I'm pretty sure that was a human error. But, you know, this flash crash we had was certainly computer generated.
John Maynard Keynes thought that emotions, or what he called animal spirits, played an important role in individual decision-making, including investment decisions. In fact, didn't he believe that professional money managers were actually just playing an intricate guessing game and might be more susceptible to irrational exuberance at times?
Yeah, he has this wonderful passage where he talks about professional investment. He likens it to what would now be considered a politically incorrect contest, where they would put up a poster of 100 attractive young women, and the goal was to guess which six would be judged the prettiest. And as he writes, the object is not to say which six you think are the prettiest, or even which six others think are the prettiest, but which six others will think, others will think, others will think. And that's the same with investing. If finding a stock that's too cheap isn't any good, if it's not going to get less cheap.
Why are hedge fund managers compensated as if they have beaten the market when they often don't?
Well, it's true that many hedge funds get paid as if the basis on which they are compared is the interest rate you'd get on a treasury bond, which is zero right now. So that's a pretty low hurdle to jump over.
In the future, you are most anxious to see the field of macroeconomics adopt the behavioral realistic approach. Why?
I think, you know, the last 7 years has shown that we were massively overconfident in the extent to which we think we could control the economy. And economists are not really in agreement about whether we should have more or less austerity. I mean, this is pretty basic. And
the big fight in Europe right now, and to some degree in this country.
Right.
When it comes to bridges and infrastructure, suddenly we talk austerity.
Yeah.
Amtrak.
And I think the last 7 years, when we've had zero interest rates and large amounts of unemployment, to not be borrowing at a zero interest rate and building roads and bridges and infrastructure is unbelievably stupid.
Paul Krugman has never deviated from his view that we should have spent more than we did. You agree?
I agree.
But that makes you a Keynesian, doesn't it?
Not necessarily. I mean, if you're a Keynesian, then you think that it's going to stimulate the economy. And I would say these investments make sense even if you don't believe in that.
But they do also create jobs.
They will create jobs. And so if there's a Keynesian multiplier, all the better. But meanwhile, half the bridges in this country need to be repaired. Why not do it now, when money is cheap and people are unemployed?
Conservatives worry that such investments won't be well spent and that the national debt will create a budgetary crisis, and then we'll wind up with out of control inflation.
Well, you know, those people were also forecasting that the quantitative easing of the Fed would lead to massive inflation, and for the last 7 years they've been wrong. I mean, it's certainly the case that if you tried to spend a lot of money very fast, some of it would have been wasted. And I think one of the mistakes we made, and it's because Congress is so inept right now, that the initial stimulus, there was a big emphasis on so-called shovel ready. And I think if we had any sense as how long this was going to last, the sensible policy would have been a very deliberate one of picking projects with high rates of return and that will, like making the railroads. The fact that we have such a horrible railroad system between Washington and Boston is just an embarrassment if you've ever been to any other country in the world.
Well, there are people in this country who see investing money in the kind of fast trains that we will find in European countries and Japan as just a waste of money. After all, we have other methods of transport that have done rather well for us.
I think in many contexts that's correct. So I'm not sold on the high-speed train in California necessarily.
Even the Elon Musk one? In the tube?
You know, if Elon Musk builds it, I will buy it. But you know, when the problem is, and actually Uber may solve this problem. The problem with taking a train to LA is that what do you do when you get there? But, you know, in the Northeast Corridor where there's such dense population, it's a no-brainer to have a good train system.
You write that one important macroeconomic policy begging for a behavioral analysis is how to fashion a tax cut aimed at stimulating the economy. How would you approach that? And how effective has trickle-down economics proven to be? Because it's still being proposed in many places. Kansas, for example, where Sam Brownback is in trouble because of what he suggested. But that doesn't mean that it isn't continually being proposed.
So I think that we have to distinguish between two different kinds of tax cuts. So what I was referring to there in that passage was the temporary tax cut at the beginning of the crisis, which was meant mostly to put money in the hands of the middle class, and you wanted them to spend it.
Did that work?
Yes, that worked. There's a poll of economists that the University of Chicago conducts, and virtually unanimous agreement that that worked. There's no incentive. There's no data to suggest that tax cuts to the rich do much of anything.
Richard H. Thaler. His latest book is Misbehaving, The Making of Behavioral Economics. It is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks so much for having me.
At first glance, Circle Mirror Transformation appears to be a lighthearted look at a drama class in a community center in Vermont. But by the end, the play turns out to be about a lot more and quite moving, which led Christopher Isherwood to write in the New York Times that he, quote, emerged with the same giddy sense of discovery, the same almost proprietary need to ensure that this small, quirky, immensely lovable new play does not go unnoticed by theatergoers. Its run has been extended any number of times, now for the fourth time through January 31st, and I'm very pleased that we were able to arrange for its playwright, Annie Baker, to come by today. And she's joined by the wonderful Deirdre O'Connell, who stars as Marty, and Tracy Chimo, who plays Lauren. Welcome to our show.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Do you all agree that this is a difficult play to describe?
Yes.
So, Annie, you wrote it. How would you describe it?
Well, it's sort of a terrible idea, I think. It's like a play about an acting class in Vermont and five people who don't know each other, who come to know each other over the course of 6 weeks, which is just a really cheesy idea.
So. Why do you think that's a cheesy idea? All the actors in the audience seemed to think it was a very good idea. They were laughing at all the stuff that was going on.
Yeah, I mean, for me, there was something I loved about it, and I didn't know exactly what it was, but I felt this inexplicable urge to write about these people in this class. And the whole time had to sort of fight myself about the fact that the idea seemed sort of like a bad one. But
and now people have told you it wasn't a bad one.
Yeah, I guess
it's a really good one.
It is a hard play to describe, though. Yeah.
Deirdre, you play Marty, who's a kind of a hippie Mother Earth instructor, leading this motley crew through exercises as though you were making them up as you go along. What was the purpose of her starting the class, as you understand it?
I think she feels a couple of things. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's not like written down in the play that I think is why she's doing it. That gets revealed very slowly through it. But I think that she's at one of those points where she needs to shake things up. She needs to shake things up in her marriage. She needs to shake things up in her life. She's searching for meaning and deepening in her life. Her stepchild has been out of the house for a while. She's at that point where she wants to know people in a different way, and she wants to help people in a different way than she's been able to. There's some longing for connection that happens.
And she's bringing all the things she learned in her previous acting classes to this class?
Yes, her acting classes, her drama therapy classes, her, various meetings with people. I think she's bringing together a potpourri of things that she's read about. She is, as you said, figuring this out as she goes along, but she's a person who's been teaching stuff for a while, so she has a kind of understanding of how to be in how to lead a group. But she is figuring some of it up as she goes along.
But as I said, the night I was there, you could hear chuckles from the actors in the audience who obviously had done similar exercises. Have you done similar exercises in
your
acting classes, Tracy?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So what happens when the audience laughs that way? Are you aware of the audience's responses, or are you just so much into the part that you...
I am completely aware. I think especially as Lauren, because I think that that character in particular is the audience to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. So I'm very much aware of audience reactions throughout the play.
The theater's very small too, so the actors can hear
everything. Everybody's everything. Yeah.
And it's very fun to notice the difference between audiences that are filled with actors and audiences that are filled with people who maybe during over the Christmas season weren't even New Yorkers, and that it's a slower seduction that happens with that kind of audience. Mm-hmm. The second it starts and we're lying on the floor, actors will start laughing hysterically.
Because they've done this exercise?
Yes. And other people will
be
like...
The rest of us say, what is that?
Why are they lying on the floor? What is this going
to
be?
Yeah. And Tracy's character serves as to some degree as the audience's surrogate. Like when you ask questions, many of us non-actors have been thinking, like, what's the point of counting to 10 while we're lying on the floor? I want to know how to become a good actress. Yeah. When are we going to act?
Yeah, I mean, Lauren wants to be an actress. She's got a big audition coming up at her high school. Mm-hmm. She wants to be Maria in West Side Story. So, yeah, she's there to learn.
Annie, how much responsibility does an acting teacher have towards his or her students? Is it possible for a teacher to wreak emotional damage, as we see in this class?
Well, you know, I'm not an experienced actor. I took one sort of disastrous acting class when I was 9 at my local public library in Amherst, Massachusetts. And we had a very intense Marty-like acting teacher who would, I can't believe this, we were 9, but she would sometimes get so angry at us that she would storm out of the building, and we'd all sort of wait terrified on stage for her to come back. And she totally wreaked emotional havoc on us. So I definitely think it's possible. But it one thing I'm interested in the play is sort of how Marty can simultaneously wreak emotional havoc on her students and also help them grow and at the same time. And that was interesting.
Well, part of acting exercises is getting people to open up.
Exactly.
And sometimes when you open up, you reveal things that you might not want to reveal. So this is it's kind of like psychotherapy at the same time.
Exactly. And she wants them to stop being self-conscious, which is a very difficult thing to ask of people, but it's also sort of a beautiful thing. So
this is also an ensemble work with each character being fully rounded. Did it take a while for the actors to develop that ensemble feeling?
I think we were blessed that this group of people has been together for most of the workshops of the play, mm-hmm. and I think Sam saw very quickly where how to build the ensemble. So we were pretty lucky. We pretty fast fell in love, and we pretty fast respected each other and understood how to be inside of each other's rhythms and stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty special. It was not difficult.
Awkward.
Yeah.
The director...
The director's name is Sam. Sam Gold.
Sam Gold, and he did this very scary, wonderful thing. In rehearsal, he had us all play the games for real. And I think at first, we all had sort of a sneering attitude towards me included, and he had us play the games for real, and some of the results were so moving. I cried one day when one of our actors, Reed Burney, retold your life story, Tracy. And it's such a cheesy exercise, but it was so moving. And we all had to sort of become foolish in the room before we portrayed these people who were also acting in a foolish way. So.
And how did you even, since you took one acting class when you were 9 years old, Annie, did you go and research this when you decided to write the play?
I did a lot of research. Yeah, before I write a play, I usually research for about 10 months. So I read so many strange drama therapy books that were written in the early 80s. And I'm dating an actor, and I'm friends with a lot of actors, so... And
they reveal stuff to you.
They reveal stuff to you. And my mother is a therapist, so I was really interested in the group therapy aspect of the play, too.
It's an unusual play in that there's a lot of silence. Is the script much shorter than other plays with actors being expected to fill in those blanks?
Yeah, the script is about 90 pages, and the play is almost 2 hours. So, and usually it's a minute a page, mm-hmm. so it... The silences do add about a half an hour to the play, I think. Yeah,
and that's something that you wrote into the play.
Yeah, I'm sort of crazy about it. I write pause, long silence, long pause. I have this whole little system. Yeah.
Well, what is it like for the actors? Does having so much time on stage when you're not talking put pressure on you? Because you still have to be engaged the whole time.
Especially at first. We sort of had to learn it. We were so used to picking up the cues that to have Sam actually say that scene wasn't long enough.
Yeah.
Was amazing for us. We're so not trained that way.
It was kind of awesome though, yeah.
And then gradually, as we gained encourage about it, now I can't imagine doing the play without all that stuff.
Tracy, your character in particular could be seen as a challenge. You play a very introspective 16-year-old who seems to be hiding in her hoodie, and you have to communicate a lot without saying anything.
Yeah, that's true. It's my favorite thing I've ever had to do, though, as an actress, honestly. I prefer not speaking. But I just...
Well, you get to say a lot of stuff.
I get to say some stuff. Yeah, no, I love that she's so behavioral. You get to just know her by watching very tiny things that she's doing.
Well, I'm assuming that it's because the play is written so well that
it's
we
so well.
Know all of these people really well. At the end, we have to know them well to... I don't want to reveal what happens in the play, but we have to know them very well to understand how the play ends. And that's because each of these characters has become a real person to us. And I'm assuming that's all in the writing, and the actors really just read the lines and do the best they can.
Well, it was because we've been
joking
working...
I was joking there.
Okay, good. Thank God. We but it has been a very long workshop process, and there
was
are...
Was there improvisation?
There was improvisation. Yeah. There's actually one scene in the play that is still improvised that I did not write, and that's the actual scene where they play the game Circle Mirror Transformation. And every night the actors improv it, and it's my favorite part because I didn't write
it. It's so much fun.
So it doesn't remain pretty much the same every night because you know
each
other.
No, we're not allowed to do
it
the same
every night. We're not allowed to do it the same every night.
We got a note the other day that we were getting into a pattern. No, we have to mix
Sammy
it up.
Sammy was like, change that up.
You guys have gotten used to getting certain, hitting certain things right with that one. So we have to change it up.
My guests are Deirdre O'Connell, the Obie-winning actress who plays Marty in Circle Mirror Transformation, Tracy Chimo, who plays Lauren, and Annie Baker is the writer of the play, which is at Playwrights Horizon at the Peter J. Sharp Theater at 416 West 42nd Street, with a run only through January 17th.
No,
31st. 31st, I'm sorry.
Extended.
So when was the original run supposed to end?
God,
Lord,
October.
I don't even remember.
17th or something?
It couldn't have been that because we started September 1st. So I think it was November 1st. We were supposed to close November 1st.
Yeah.
And then the play has been so well received that you had to extend it?
Mm-hmm.
And then again?
And again?
Does that mean it can happen again?
I don't think so.
We can't
not
extend
at
it in that theater.
Yeah.
So it would have to move, and that's a very hard thing to do right now.
Yeah. So I think this is it.
Oh, well, it can always be performed again somewhere else, can't it?
Everyone's trying for,
Annie, when you started, did you have a sense of who all these characters were when you started writing it?
That's sort of the only thing I had. Yeah, I had no idea what was going to happen in the play. I just had these five characters, and I had lots of notes about their life and about their relationships with each other. So I usually start with characters, and so I knew them very well, and one of the first things I wrote in the play was at the beginning of each week they deliver a monologue as another character. It's sort of part of the class. It's an acting exercise, and those were the first things I wrote. So I sort of knew their life stories. Yeah.
Although you tell us, you reveal an awful lot, and we know learn a lot about them, but you reveal it in a sideways fashion.
Yeah, that was very important to me. I hate exposition in plays. I hate when people are sort of sitting in a living room and saying, "Remember how 5 years ago we met and got married, and now we're
and
angry
now we have
at
two
our
children,
son, and now
bud,
we have two children, and it's cold outside, and it's Christmas." You know, I sort of wanted to write a play where there was no exposition, or the exposition was an exercise. That was sort of the experiment, And it was really fun. It was really fun to try.
Well, as actors, Deirdre and Tracy, how long did it take you to get your characters? Or is that something that's still evolving?
It's still evolving.
Yeah.
It really is. Play has this sort of bottomless quality about it, because I think the fact that Annie has sidestepped that exposition is such an important and remarkable thing. I think that we're so used to, as audience members, sort of allowing for behavior that wouldn't happen in real life all the time in plays, and going, okay, but that's fine, because I want to know that it's Christmas, and I want to know that they've been married for 20 years, so it's okay that these poor actors have to say this, and it's a little fake. When you don't have that, the contract changes. There's no room for faking anything. So
but
the acting becomes actually really rigorous, because you're under this different kind of microscope. There's not a deal that you'll do some fake stuff to help us. So we don't get to do any fake stuff to help the audience.
Yeah. There's an immense amount of freedom, though, in what Annie has written for us, you know, within the pauses and within the almost sparseness of it. We're not beating anybody over the head with our characters, so there is lots of room to play.
It's actually the way you really do get to know people.
Yeah.
You know them
yeah.
really well, but even though you might not. Actually, I can't remember where they're from.
I don't know every detail about this person, yeah. but I'm falling in love with them.
Yeah.
yeah.
Well, we all unfold, you know, or people learn about us the way you peel an onion layer yeah. by layer, and there are certain things that you might not, that are really important, that you may not discover until much later, and that's part of what you've done in this play. But how important was it for you to set it in Vermont rather than, let's say, an acting class in New York?
Yeah, I have this imaginary town in Vermont in my head. Shirley, Vermont, and a bunch of my plays take place there. And I really need to start writing about a different town. But the problem is that I've thought about this town so much. I know about 500 of its residents. So it's always so tempting. So actually, you know, I'm going to sound like a psychopath, but, you know, a couple of people in Circle Mirror Transformation are related to a couple of people and, you know, second cousins of people in the other play, or Marty was married. Her first marriage was to someone in my it's very hard for me to not write a play that takes place in that town. I also love small towns, and I'm really interested in how the arts function in small towns. It's very different than in New York City.
Well, you are from Amherst,
yes.
but Amherst is a college town.
It's
a very different kind
town.
Of town.
Yeah, Shirley is actually a college town too. But yes.
And
yeah.
when did you write your first play? Did it grow out of going to NYU's College of the Arts and Sciences?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote some really bad plays when I was a teenager. I'm still writing some really bad plays, but I guess I wrote my first
But plays,
full
rather
length.
Than screenplays or short
yeah,
stories?
Yeah, I used to write those too, and I still do, but I guess my first full-length play I wrote my senior year of college, yeah.
Deirdre, you've been in more productions than I can list, and you got an Obie?
Yes. A couple of years ago, I got an Obie for Sustained Excellence of Performance. That's how you say
wow.
it, right?
What does that mean?
That's awesome.
It means that they forgot to give you one before. It sort of does.
Uh-huh.
It sort of means that you know, you
a lifetime achievement.
You come up in the meeting at the Obie committee, and they're like, wait a second, didn't she get an Obie for this or that? And they go, no, she didn't. Well, wait a second.
We're going to give her one now.
Yeah. It sort of happens like that. But it's really nice when it happens.
Chasey, you were just on Broadway with Tova Feltu
yeah.
in Irina's Vow, a very different kind of play.
Yes, very different.
And you'd been in the off-Broadway production, and then it transferred. That must have been great as well.
Oh, it was amazing.
Just honored by Marion Seldes and the O'Neill Studio.
Yes, yeah, I won the O'Neill Award for making my Broadway debut with Irina's Vow. It was pretty neat.
We have very little time left, but Annie, as we were leaving the theater, the audience was given an interview that you did, in which you said you don't like talking about your work. In fact, you conducted the interview by email. I really appreciate that you were willing to come to our studio and talk with me
today. Thank you. My heart is beating very
Are you really
fast.
Nervous?
I am. I'm so nervous. I just hate talking. If I could, I would communicate by writing on little index cards and showing them to everybody.
Well, write down when your play, The Aliens, will be opening.
Yes, it's opening in April.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
is that
yeah.
similar people or related people?
It's in the same town. But it's about three young men. I sort of was interested in writing a dude play. So this is my all male cast.
Well, thank you both. Thank you all for being with us. Annie Baker, the playwright, Circle Mirror Transformation at Playwrights Horizons, Peter J. Sharp Theater at 416 West 42nd Street. There's ticket information on our show page at WNYC.org. Also, actresses Deirdre O'Connell and Tracy Chimo.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last night, a federal judge in Hawaii issued a nationwide order blocking President Trump's revised travel ban, which would have shut off entry for 90 days from six Muslim-majority nations and suspended all refugee admissions for 120 days. At a time when millions of Syrians have been forced out of their home country by war and violence, Viet Thanh Nguyen's new collection of eight short stories called The Refugees gives voice to the Vietnamese who sought shelter in the United States during the final days of the Vietnam War. It's published by Grove Press. Mr. Nguyen is the Errol Arnold Chair of English and Professor of English and American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California. His debut novel, The Sympathizer, won the 2016 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. And I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Good to see you again.
Great to be back, Leonard.
You dedicate your book, quote, to all refugees everywhere. Is there something universal about the refugee experience?
I think so. I think those of us who have been refugees will have never forgotten that experience of being unwanted and displaced and scrambling for our lives and having lost so many things. So when I see the plight of contemporary refugees today, I see the pictures of what's happening to them, my heart goes out to them.
Are the ways that Americans think about refugees from Vietnam different from the way Syrian refugees are perceived?
To some extent now, I think so. But you have to remember that in 1975, when Vietnamese refugees were hot news, the majority of Americans didn't want to take Vietnamese refugees in. It took an act of Congress to welcome Vietnamese and other Southeast Asian refugees. And now, 40-some years later, we look at Vietnamese refugees and we think they're a success story, but they must be unique. They must be different than Syrian refugees or other Muslim refugees. And I don't necessarily think that's true.
Do you think there's more fear today?
Oh, there's definitely more fear today. And it's wrapped up with the contemporary phobias around immigration, but also especially Muslim immigrants and the war on terror and all that.
Well, there were fears earlier of Chinese swamping America, and laws were passed to prevent that from happening. Did the Vietnamese, were they able to avoid that sort of thing because they were coming later after the laws about the Chinese had been changed?
You look back on the depictions of the Chinese in the 19th century, they were awful. They were incredibly racist, worse than what we're using to depict Muslims today. But by the time the Vietnamese refugees came, that had been abated a little bit. But I remember when my parents opened a store in San Jose, California in 1978, another store down the street had a sign that said, "Another American driven out of business by the Vietnamese." So some of those fears are still there.
Do you think readers will pity your characters?
I hope not.
Should they?
They shouldn't. I mean, what they should do is they should empathize. They should recognize a common humanity. And they should recognize that what happened to Vietnamese refugees could just as easily have happened to them in similar circumstances.
How old were you when you and your family left Vietnam?
I was four.
Where did you live when you first arrived here?
We went first to Fort Indiantown Gap in Pennsylvania, which was one of four military bases that were used to resettle refugees.
So it was a refugee camp?
There was a refugee camp in the base. Mm-hmm. And in order to leave, you had to have a sponsor to guarantee that you wouldn't be a drain on the American welfare system. So my parents went to one sponsor, my 10-year-old brother went to another, and 4-year-old me went to a third. And that was a very traumatic experience for a 4-year-old.
And was life okay in the refugee camp? Because when we talk about the Japanese internment camps, we find out that they were rather unpleasant places.
They were very different kinds of camps. And you have to remember that Franklin Delano Roosevelt called the internment camps concentration camps when they were first founded, before it became, you know, bad to use that term. But the refugee camps were different. I mean, they were definitely temporary.
And your parents decided to move to California. They could have gone to other places. A lot of Vietnamese people went to the American South, to Houston and parts of the Gulf Coast.
Because where it was warm, where there was good benefits, where there was good economic opportunities, and they heard about California, which is still really like the mecca for Vietnamese refugees.
Did you ever feel like you were an outsider when you were growing up?
To some extent. I think that I certainly grew up as an American, but if you watched American movies about the Vietnam War, as I did, you realized that the Vietnamese did not belong in the American consciousness.
In your book's acknowledgments, you thank your parents, Joseph and Linda, who were, quote, refugees in 1954 and again in 1975. Why were they refugees in 1954?
Well, the country was divided into North and South, and what happened was that 800,000 Vietnamese Catholics, of whom my parents were a part, fled from the North to the South because they were afraid of communist persecution, which meant that my dad did not see his relatives for 40 years until he was able to return to the North.
And when you look at what's going on in Korea, do you see any similarities?
Well, that was the great what if, the parallel history. Like, what if the United States had been successful and North and South Vietnam had remained divided? Would South Vietnam have turned into South Korea? And it's possible that that could have been the case. You have to remember that South Korea during the 1960s was poorer than South Vietnam. And it was because of the South Korean participation in the Vietnam War that helped to turn them into the global economy they are today.
You told your novel, The Sympathizer, from the perspective of a South Vietnamese captain who was secretly working as a spy for the Viet Cong. In this book, the stories are all seen through the eyes of refugees fleeing the Viet Cong.
Yeah, and it was these stories were actually written before The Sympathizer, and the intention of the stories was to humanize Vietnamese refugees, to look at their domestic lives, to look at how they were suffering and how those emotions were similar to what we all feel.
And your first story, Black-Eyed Woman, is about a writer who is haunted by ghosts. Who is the ghost that visits her mother?
What happened is that the family has fled as the so-called boat people, and one of them didn't make it, her brother. And 25 years later, he returns to them after having swam across the Pacific and arrives on their doorstep at night, dripping wet. And the reason I wrote this story was because these kinds of stories of ghosts visiting Vietnamese people after they've passed are very, very common.
But she thinks her mother is starting to become senile. When she talks about the ghost.
If my mother told me there was a ghost knocking on the door, I'd either be frightened or I'd have to think that my mother is senile.
And, of course, there's a almost like a wordplay here, because the narrator has resigned herself to being a ghost writer and not putting her own name on her work. She's writing memoirs for survivors of disasters and other traumatic events.
It's a nice little plot hook, but I was also thinking about the fact that many of us who are writers who deal with traumatic events or historical events, we are ghost writers because we have to confront the ghosts of the past.
Including our own pasts.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I'm certainly haunted by the ghosts of my own past, even if they're not as dramatic as that. And those who have, you know, remembered the trauma and the suffering that they've been through, they find it very hard oftentimes to let go.
She says, looking back, however, I could see that we had passed our youth in a haunted country. What does she mean by that?
I think that Vietnam, during that time period, whether you're living in the North or the South, was undergoing tremendous difficulties because of the war. And there were already people who were refugees and who had lost loved ones during that conflict.
And it sounds as if she wants to forget what she's been through, but at the same time doesn't want the memories of her brother to fade. Some people are haunted by the past whether they want to be or not.
Yeah, and it's a dilemma. Of course we have to forget in order to move on, but what's the proper balance, the proper ratio between memory and forgetting? And that's partly what the story explores. She has to confront her own past, what happened to her on that boat, before she can move on.
She says, stories are just things we fabricate, nothing more. We search for them in a world besides our own and then leave them here to be found, garments shed by ghosts. What purposes do stories serve?
I think that stories keep the past alive. They keep the dead alive. And for many of us who are writers and lovers of literature, stories are real. They're material. So the ghost, which we may think of as a fiction, stands in for the fact that this past actually is material and substantive for many of us.
My guess is Viet Thanh Nguyen. His latest book is a collection of short stories called The Refugees. The story called War Years deals with a young boy and his parents who own a Vietnamese grocery store in San Jose. Should I assume that was inspired by events in your own life?
It's the only autobiographical story I've ever written.
A neighbor, Mrs. Huo, am I pronouncing that right?
Hua.
Repeatedly asked the boy's mother for donations in support of anti-communist guerrillas back home. We're talking about 1983. Is she struggling to come to terms with the disappearance of her husband and son? In other words, back to the ghosts in a way?
Yeah. I mean, she comes off initially as a terrible figure because she's trying to extort money. But we find out that she's lost all the loved ones in her life to this war. And I knew many people or heard of many people like that.
And she's extorting money? She's not really ready to send that money back?
Well, I mean, the ostensible purpose is to fund the Vietnamese effort to take Vietnam back, which was a real effort, and I talk a lot about more about that in The Sympathizer. But nevertheless, when you're telling people you either have to give money or we're going to call you a communist, that's extortion.
In the story Fatherland, Vivian, a young woman living in the United States, visits her father and his family in Vietnam for the first time in her life. What does she expect from the visit?
Well, what she expects is to reconnect with the land of her origins and this father who she hasn't known for 20 years. And the other part of the plot is that the father has had three more children who he's named after the first three children who have left. And that's actually based on a real anecdote that someone told me about her own family.
They're all named Phuong?
Phuong, I believe.
Phuong. It's hard for a non-Vietnamese to know how to pronounce these things. But why would somebody do that, to name all of his daughters the same name?
It did happen. That's the true anecdote that was told to me. And then I made up the rest of the story to try to put in, to explain why someone would do that.
What does her half-sister Phuong, who grew up in Vietnam, think of her?
Well, she has grown up with this fantasy about this other sister who has her name first, who has gone to the United States and has lived this glorious, glamorous life. And that was true for a lot of Vietnamese people in the 1980s and 1990s, as they were suffering under poverty and so on. They thought that the relatives who had fled were living this American dream.
But Vivian is also disappointed.
Well, number one, Vivian is not living the American dream. She comes back and it's revealed that her life is not as great as everybody has believed it to be.
Their father works as a tour guide in Saigon, mainly for American tourists. What are those tours like?
This is also based on a true story. I went on one of these tours to visit the Coochie Tunnels, which is, you know, a site that all American tourists have to go visit. And my tour guide said, "We won this war." Well, the thing is, I had a coffee break with him, and he said, "Oh, yeah, I actually fought for South Vietnam." But for him to make a living, he had to pretend that he fought for the victorious side. That to me just brought up, the ironic situation that so many Vietnamese people are caught up in.
Well, I would assume a great number of the people who are living in what was once called South Vietnam were opposed to being annexed by the North, and now they have to live as citizens of this unified country, whether they like it or not.
Right.
And so they all have to say, I'm loyal to my current country.
Right. And they have to make a living. But, you know, when tourists encounter them, they only encounter the persona or the story that's being fabricated. And this story looks behind that at the more difficult lives that these people are living.
Phuong goes on one of those tours, and we hear her reaction at one point. She says, "We're all the same to them." Phuong understood with a mix of anger and shame, small, charming, and forgettable.
I went to this restaurant that's featured in the story, and I talked to this very pretty young woman who's a hostess there, and I said, "Hey, Saigon is really exciting." And she just looked at me and said, "No, Saigon's really boring." And that always stayed with me, that the lives that these people are living, the ones who encounter tourists, are very different than what the tourists themselves see.
So you've gone to Vietnam?
Five or six times. Yeah, 5 or 6 times.
And is it changing, or has it pretty much become solidified since the communists took over the whole country?
It's changed drastically over the last 40 years, and year by year it becomes more and more developed, at least the urban and the tourist and coastal areas. So you can go to Vietnam, and even though it's officially a communist country, you would never know that as long as you didn't deal with politics.
Would it be different if you're going to the south or the north?
Yeah, there are cultural differences, but ironically the north, even though it's a center of the Communist Party, it's extremely capitalist.
Really?
Yes. And there's a
stereotype. Same as China, in a way?
Yeah. And basically, there are a lot of regional stereotypes, and the Southerners really don't like the Northerners because they think they're hypocrites, that they're talking the Communist Party line, but they're the worst capitalists of all.
So you wrote these short stories and then published the novel, got the Pulitzer Prize. Now the short stories can be published. What are you working on now? More stories or another novel?
The sequel to The Sympathizer, He Lives. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in what happens to him after that.
And does that happen with the stories as well? Because writers often have told me that just because they've finished something, a story or a novel, that doesn't mean that that character stopped talking to them.
I don't think so. I mean, the stories, you have to end the stories somewhere in a short story, but their lives go on, and I'm certainly very curious about some of the characters, what happens to them later.
Viet Thanh Nguyen, his latest book is a collection of short stories called The Refugees. It's published by Grove Press. And thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thanks for having me, Leonard.